Thank you, Graham. Actually, before we get started, I think I should acknowledge the cold hand of Bill Plapp in this, because a lot of the things we've talked about today actually have their origins in things that Bill Plapp did, including, I was struck in Shelby's presentation, it was Bill Plapp who organized the vial test, or he used to call it the vial test, for Heliothus resistance, and even the diagnostic dose that was mentioned so frequently today, 5 parts per million, was one that Bill pioneered in the early 1980s. Today we're really focused on looking at an old recurrent issue about rotations, mixtures, and also looking at this in the context of managing cross resistance. And this too is work, a lot of which has its origins in the 1980s, but it still seems to be something that keeps coming up in various contexts, and it's probably worth revisiting again. So, I'll just. There we go. One of the main points I want to make this morning is pesticide mixtures do not necessarily slow resistance, but under certain circumstances you can actually accelerate resistance compared to rotations or the sequential introduction of pesticides. And you'll have to trust me on this for a moment. I can answer questions about it later, but essentially rotating pesticides over time and then using a pesticide up, just using one continuously until it fails and moving on to the next one, are essentially the same in terms of the additive delay of resistance you get. And what I'll really be arguing for is that you should be rotating instead. And just to try to illustrate some of the generality of this, I'll give you some data that's been generated in Australia on resistance management for the herbicide Roundup, trade name of the active ingredient for glyphosate. So fundamentally, about the notion about mixtures managing resistance is that the underlying theory that a lot of people focus on is that the idea that it's very unlikely that if the pest is resistant to one pesticide, it'll also be resistant to the other. So if it's resistant to the first one, you figure you can kill it with the second one. And it's such a straightforward idea that it's actually seductive in simplicity and actually misleads you, because it's much more complicated than that. It really is an example of a saying from Will Rogers, the late cowboy comedian, who commented, ignorance ain't what you don't know, it's what you do know that ain't correct. And that's usually the kind of misinformation that we're most afflicted by when we think we know something that's actually not right. And that's the problem with looking at mixture strategies, is that in their simplicity, they're a bit too seductive. A more precise statement of the underlying theory would be that mixtures work by redundant killing. That is to say, you're applying pesticides at a dose that's sufficient to kill the susceptible genotypes twice. And interestingly enough, both Hugh Cummins in Australia and Fred Gould in the United States quite independently, coined this idea for two different kinds of systems they were thinking about in 1986. And so one of the things I want to propose today is let redundant killing be your guide in trying to understand how these strategies work. So what you can really think of is, if you look at it from the standpoint of redundant killing, you can think of rotations and mixtures as a continuum against a scale of redundant killing, where you either have it or don't have it at all, and the best results are at either end of that continuum. And I'll try to illustrate that as I go along. So with respect to can mixtures manage resistance, it turns out that in the case of insecticides alone, this is not supported by models, which I showed in Pesticide Science in 1989, and Bruce Sebastian showed wasn't consistent with experiments in the Journal of Economic Entomology in 1989. The one exception across all pesticides where I'm prepared to concede that mixtures actually can work is in the mixtures of protectant and systemic fungicides. But they're quite unique because of the way they work. And I won't talk about that in great deal of detail now, but be happy to answer questions about it later. But I'm prepared to accept that those are an exception. The other thing that's misleading about this is, under laboratory conditions, you can make the mixtures work really well if you're unrealistic about what happens with residue decay, and I'll try to explain that as I go along as well. So a lot of times you look at laboratory experiments and people made mixtures work very successfully, but I'll give you an example where I can make it either work or fail depending on how I control residue decay. So the classical assumptions about mixtures or pyrimidding 2BT genes in plants include that there's no cross resistance between the compounds or the targets, and historically we've had to guess at this based on the target site of the pesticide. We really didn't know the cross-resistant patterns at the level of metabolism for resistance, so we guessed at it on the basis of the target. And I'm actually going to compare mixtures and pyrimids through my talk, because many of you will also know that even as I'm going to heap some doubt on mixtures of pesticides today, I'm a strong advocate for the idea of using mixtures of toxins, pyrimidings, for BT plants. And I want to show you why there's a difference between the two. It also assumes that there's initially a low resistance frequency, less than 1%. The resistance to at least one of the toxins needs to be at least somewhat recessive, which was demonstrated quite convincingly by Manny in Genetics, the journal Genetics in 1985. And the other one is that people often used to say that you should have equal decay rates. It turns out it's more complicated than that. It's not just equal decay rates, it's that the things effectively can't decay at all or have to decay very rapidly. And I'll try to get to that in a few minutes as well. So if you look at this from the standpoint of gene frequencies, if you're looking at mixers or pyramids for BT plants, if you look at the genotypes that are involved, the most common genotype will be the susceptible genotypes. They're susceptible to both the loci you're interested at. And their frequencies, if P represents the frequency of the susceptible allele, this would be the frequency of these genotypes, which you could round off to nearly 100%. The other genotypes are much less common. So these are the heterozygotes for one or heterozygotes for the other. And of course, their frequency would be just this from Hardy-Weinberg, where Q represents a frequency of resistance. And then you could look at the less common genotypes that are double heterozygotes. Now, what people have tended to focus on in thinking about managing by mixtures is these double heterozygotes, that these individuals really are very rare, that are resistant to both pesticides simultaneously. But that's not where the most powerful selection for resistance occurs. Selection for resistance in the system occurs for these genotypes. When you start to, where the pesticide residues decay to the point where not all the susceptibles for one genotype or the other are being killed. So the question I'd have to ask you is, when you spray a pesticide, how many people here have ever seen 100% control, absolutely 100% control of the pest? How many people have routinely seen 95% control of the pest routinely? It turns out that the threshold for making this work is you have to get at least 95% control, even in the first hit. And surely, 2 or 3 days after the pesticide's been sprayed, or a week after the pesticide's been sprayed, the residues decay to the point where you're not getting complete control of susceptible insects. That's even true if you hit them initially and got everything. But most of the insects we target, say Heliothus or Helicoverpa, in crops, we've got a whole range of instars at the time we spray. We usually knock the first instars, second instars out very easily, third and fourth instars, fifth instars, less so, to the point where fifth and sixth instars you usually can't kill at all. And it's those individuals that are carrying one resistance gene and not both that are relatively common. I think I skipped ahead here. Let's go back. Oops, no, I'm going the wrong way. There we go. It's these individuals that are relatively more common. They're carrying just one of the resistance alleles, where the selection for resistance is most strong. These are so rare that they're probably not playing in it. So it's the doubly resistant individuals that are rare, but survival of these genotypes are carrying just one that really drives the evolution of resistance. And again, the key is redundant killing. If the mortality of these susceptible-bearing genotypes must be greater than 95% for this to really work well. So when the residues decay to the point of only about 80% of being killed, you get really no benefit to mixing, or in the case of ET plants, pyramids. So I'm still having problems getting, there we go. No, having trouble advancing here. There we go. So if I want to look at pyramiding, these resistance genes, and pyramiding being the same thing as a mixture, which you see, this is a case where I assume that 70% of the heterozygotes are being killed by each pesticide, and this is where I assume 50% were being killed by each pesticide. So clearly, the closer you go to recessiveness of the gene, that is to say, increased mortality of the heterozygotes, the greater the delay of resistance that you get. And what you see is that resistance delay from these mixtures of pyramids can be quite spectacular when mortality is greater than 95%. When you drop off the point where the susceptibles, fewer than 80% of the susceptibles are being killed, you see there's very little to distinguish between these strategies, no matter what the mortality of the heterozygotes is. So it's really critical that you get very high mortality of the susceptibles to drive to make the system work. If you fail to do so, you don't get a great delay of resistance. So it's not just equal decay rates that are important. Mixtures are not promising because the loss of redundant killing from incomplete coverage of the crop, incomplete kill because of the different life stages, or residue decay. All those factors, even if you have absolutely parallel decay rates, can cause these mixtures to fail. So what it means is either decay has to occur not at all, or it has to occur so rapidly so that transition period is short. So I want to turn then to the middle two assumptions I gave about the low initial gene frequency and that they need to be recessive, and look at this again in terms of gene frequency. And what I want to illustrate here is it really says that the initial gene frequency has to be pretty low. If the gene frequency when you start is about 10 to the minus 2, again using the same assumptions I did before about the mortality of heterozygotes, you see there's very little advantage to pyrimiding or mixing compared to just introducing pesticides sequentially, that you get your best benefits when the initial resistance allele frequencies are very low. But I ask you, when is it that people usually start thinking about mixtures? Is it when the pesticides are first introduced? No, it's when they've already had control failures, which means what? You're over here someplace. Exactly the conditions when they'd be most likely not to work. So if you're going to go down this pathway at all, you have to do it at the beginning, before people actually think they're ever going to have a problem, and when they're prepared to pay twice as much on their pesticide bills by spraying, nearly applying good rates of both pesticides from the very beginning, even before they have a problem. It's another thing that weighs against it. The other problem with this is that although we tend to pick the pesticides we use in the mixture based on their target site, we know there's another major class of mechanisms of resistance to pesticides that lurks out there, and that's increased metabolism. And they often cross chemical boundaries and cross the boundaries of what target sites you have. So as soon as you start applying pesticide mixtures, you would surely be selecting for those resistance mechanisms that confer those areas of broad cross resistance. Now, Roman Sawicki in particular, back in the 70s, was trying to look at how you could sequentially introduce pesticides to reduce this problem. And one of his arguments even then, with a fair amount of evidence in house flies, was you take the simplest compounds first because you select for the simplest mechanisms, and then you'd move on to more complex things. You would start with malathion first before you'd start off with dimethoate, because you get malathion resistance, but dimethoate would still be useful. But if you started with dimethoate, you'd take out malathion at the same time. It seems to me the same principle, the same risk applies to using these mixtures of toxins. The other thing that you should consider is that pesticide mixtures are less likely to preserve beneficials because it's very likely that both of the mixing partners will be selected for the beneficials. We live in an era that's far different than the 70s and 80s and even the 90s. We have a broad range of new pesticides, many of which are quite selective for natural enemies, but not all of them are. It's really a great asset to be able to apply pesticides that are selective, save the natural enemies so they might continue to reduce pest problems, even feed on the resistant survivors. But we negate those benefits if we mix pesticides and end up with one of the mixing partners is not selective. We don't get the benefit from the one that is. So rather than double pesticide use and cost in mixtures, it really is important to rotate or alternate things seasonally and not use them as mosaics, which is something Tony Shelton talked about earlier. And mosaics can occur when neighbors use different pesticide classes and pests interbreed across generations. Essentially, what's happening in this case is the redundant killing that Gould and Cummins talked about starts to fall apart miserably because you get some exposure to some of the population with one toxin, some with the other, and that's what helps drive resistance more rapidly. So these are some experiments I did on mosquitoes when I was at Cornell, where I left 10% of the population unexposed. I used DDT and Dieldrin resistance. We knew very well what they were. They were mapped on different chromosomes. And I split the population where half the population we could treat with DDT and half with Dieldrin in the mosaic treatments. And then I mixed them with the refuge counterparts every generation. You can see that what happened is I got a pretty fair level of resistance in terms of survival of the insects in four or five generations. But if instead I used DDT one generation, Dieldrin the next, I could get at least seven generations of control out of this. So the rotation or alternation strategy worked better. And there are lots of examples of this in the field. This is some work from David Pree in Canada. He started out with a fairly significant problem of resistance OP and OP and pyrethroid insecticides in the oriental fruit moth. He got his growers onto a seasonal rotation program where they're using different insecticides at different times of year. And you can see that over time, they were able to get a fairly significant reduction in the overall level of pesticide resistance they had to deal with, and they were able to manage the pests more successfully. But going back to the system I did with mosquitoes, for the lack of time, I won't try to explain these results in a lot of detail, but by manipulating how I exposed the mosquitoes for mixture experiments, I could either make the system last for only six generations, or I could make it last for 30 till I got bored and quit. So if I really wanted to make this system last a long time, I would put both insecticides at high rates, only expose the insects to a high rate of both insecticides at the same time, with refuge, and I could delay resistance a long time. But if I made a system that was much more realistic to the field, where I split the population up, treated some with a high dose, some with successively lower doses, what you'd actually see is it's in the lower dose experiments, you'd see some mosquitoes surviving. Even though there was some element of both pesticides there, some of them would survive. You could visually see that's where resistance is occurring, because some insects are surviving. So if I did that approach and had a decay rate that allowed a lot of exposure to insects at less than doses that killed all the heterozygotes, or even less than doses that killed all the susceptible homozygotes, I could get resistance quite rapidly, even faster than I could in this system. So that's what I mean. You can manipulate dose to make the experiments do whatever you want, which illustrates the point about why BT, why pyramids could be recommended for BT plants. That's more promising. You get more complete coverage because it's integrated in the plant. There's typically, we're trying to control Lepidoptera. The first feed is neonate larvae, so you don't have a range of larval life stages you're trying to control. There's relatively little residue decay. We know that in cotton, for example, the Cry1A toxins decline over time, but still not as sharply and steeply as you would get from repeated exposures to insecticides. The other thing that works well for the system is that there's a fair amount of evidence that at least some of the BT genes have fairly recessive expression in the insects, which also augurs well for the success of the strategy. So again, whether mixtures of pyramids can work or fail is really dependent on these conditions and how well they meet the assumptions, and particularly assumptions like residue decay rates. We tested some of these kinds of ideas in the diamondback moth, as Tony Shelton was talking about earlier, resistant to BT in lots of places in the world, including two different BT varieties. This shows the results of some experiments he did looking at pyramiding genes, where in the pyramided one we used both the Cry1A and Cry1C genes together. And on the other side, we had mosaic strategy. In both of these, we had about 10% of the plants in refuge. But these had just Cry1AC and Cry1C, and after about 18 generations, both were failing in the mosaic strategy. The data for that looked something like this, where if you look at the larval density over time, the pyramid strategy kept the larval densities very low, despite the fact that we had a fairly high initial gene frequency to start with. But the mosaic strategies, in particular, shot up quite quickly. In particular, I want to draw your attention to the fact that even with the Cry1C, which was a bit tougher to get resistance to, you pretty much lost control of things after about 18 generations. Now, we did another experiment where we said, what if we have a mosaic strategy, but half the plants are only expressing one of the genes and half of them are expressing both? Can you really get a sufficient, can you get much of a delay of resistance in this? And what we concluded is that you really need to avoid mixing these. This comes from work that was published in PNAS in 2005. And what it illustrates in this case is whether you look at the plants that are expressing only the one toxin, just the one AC or the one C, or looking at both toxins expressed together, the system failed quite rapidly. And it's because these that are only expressing one of the toxins select quite rapidly for that form of resistance, and it eventually takes out the two gene plants. And the point I want to draw your attention to is in the last experiment, I showed you that it lasts about 18 generations. In this one, you pretty much get control failures even on the two gene plants after about 21 generations or so. In other words, if you had sort of a mixed bag where you had some mixing and some incomplete exposure, in this case plants are only expressing one toxin, you didn't get very much of a delay of resistance at all from having had the two toxin, the mixture strategy present. It's really critical that you either go, as Hugh Cummins once wrote in one of his articles, what you want to have is high serial correlation of exposure to the toxins. Either they get whacked with both of them or they get none. Or another way of looking at it is you're going to expose something to one of these toxins. You want to do so with extreme prejudice. You want to make sure they die. So if you're going to expose them to both, make sure they die, or don't expose them to either one or expose them only to one of them. I would just illustrate this because a lot of people seem to think that there's something unique that these systems are working for weeds with mixtures or they're working for insects. The fact is they don't work in any system. Now, one of the ones that we work on a lot in Australia is looking at how to manage resistance to glyphosate, Roundup. And this is a case where in principle we have two herbicides that really do have very short decay rates effectively in the field, glyphosate and paraquat, which basically you spray, you can go back out the day after you spray and direct drill in a crop and grow a crop. So they have very short persistence. So you might think this would be a system where this could work, but not necessarily. So what we find is a case where resistance occurs to glyphosate. It's after very intensive use. It's hard to get resistance to this, but people are managing to do it. The same thing's happening across the United States. And Chris Preston in particular did these experiments where he was looking at how you might manage resistance. We were skeptical of mixture strategies. So he started off with a strain that was modestly resistant, that where resistance was already incorporated in the strain of ryegrass. He looked at what happens if you treat it once or twice during each year with glyphosate, or once or twice each year with paraquat, another knockdown herbicide, and then looked at a strategy that's widely called in Australia the double knock, where you essentially apply glyphosate followed a week later by paraquat to try to control the weeds. And this is what he found. This is the susceptible control. Essentially, there's no survival at the dose of the pesticides that are being used. This is the untreated one. And it's, that gives you an idea of how, that this was a fairly modestly resistant strain. There was a lot of resistance out there already. So that's its survival to glyphosate. This is what happened if you treated once with glyphosate or twice with glyphosate, which was consistent with their models, that it's not the frequency of times in the year you treat so much as the number of years it gets treated. This is what happened with the double knock strategy. One treatment with glyphosate, one treatment with paraquat. Basically, the paraquat application didn't do anything to suppress glyphosate resistance. It suppressed weed density a bit, but it didn't do anything for resistance management purposes. And two applications of paraquat actually saw a decline of resistant glyphosate because it has strong fitness costs. So what was going on here? We knew from other evidence, the reason we were actually convinced that this would be the outcome, is we knew that glyphosate only gave about 90% control in paraquat, especially at the time it was applied, only about 80% control. So from the models we ran, the same ones I showed you for pyrimidding, there was no reason to expect this strategy to work, and the experiments demonstrated that it didn't. There was no net benefit from using this mixture and trying to delay resistance. It suppressed the density of the weeds a bit, but didn't change the frequency of resistance to glyphosate after the first application. So my conclusions from all this is, you know, these are some rules you can apply across a wide range of taxa. It's not unique to insects. And you could think about this. You could let redundant killing be your guide in terms of trying to think about whether a strategy for mixtures is likely to work or not. Are you really going to achieve a high level redundant killing? Maybe it's got a possibility. If not, look to something else. And a general conclusion from this is that in most pesticide cases, you really should probably be looking at pesticide rotations, not mixtures, as a way of slowing resistance most cost effectively and also saving beneficials in the population while avoiding selection for metabolic forms of cross resistance. Thank you very much.